Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Anne Lamott, who reads from and discusses the paperback edition of her acclaimed book, Plan B, Further Thoughts on Faith, published by Penguin. In the weeks to come, we have William Haywood Henderson, John Perkins, Rick Riley, Nando Parado, Augustine Burroughs, Madeline Albright, Elizabeth Strout, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. It's so nice to have you all here this evening for a wonderful occasion. Well, what do you do when you're turning 50, are the single mother of an adolescent, and you have a fight with the leaders of your country? Well, if you're Annie Lamott, you turn to Plan B, Further Thoughts on Faith. Annie is a born-again Christian that liberals love and that evangelicals respect, although they might wish she had a less familiar way of speaking about the Almighty. In fact, lots of people love and respect Annie because she bears her soul and tells the truth, and what's more, is funny. Her readers have followed her through the many changes in her life, the birth and first year of a love-hate relationship with a colicky baby chronicled in Operating Instructions, and her conversion from former druggie and alcoholic to born-again Christian in Tender Mercies. Her novels are equally beloved, Hard Laughter, Rosie, Joe Jones, Crooked Little Heart, and Blue Shoe. Her book on writing, Bird by Bird, has become a classic and is treasured not only by writers and would-be writers, but also those who would like to find out the mystery behind putting pen to paper. In talking with one of my colleagues, Richard Burton, today about Annie, he said, "Humanity spills off every page she writes." He also said after reading Tender Mercies, he just wanted to fly out to California and give her a hug, but knew he was just one of thousands who feel the same way. That is the effect her writing has on people. Please join me in welcoming Annie Lamott.
Thank you. There's space on the floor up here. If you want to come up and plop on the floor, it looks like a lawn. Well, last night for the event in Powell's, we began by singing My Country Tis of Thee, Sweet Land of Liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountainside let freedom ring. So I thought I'd give you the opportunity to sing it if you felt like it, but it doesn't look like a, maybe it's not such a singing bunch. Raise your hand if you would like to begin by singing My Country Tis of Thee. Okay. Okay, he goes, My country tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountainside let freedom ring. Okay, so I can sit right there. They're major donors. Still seats on the lawn up here if you need them. So, and I'm sort of sick of Bush today. So So I thought my very favorite piece in Plan B is not, we have business to attend to. I'm going to read my favorite piece, although I'm not sure it's a piece that reads best, but it's a piece I love the most and I'm most glad I wrote. And I haven't read it on tour. I've been on tour for a few weeks, and I don't think I've ever read it out loud. But that book on the shelves back there, Abide With Me by Elizabeth Strout, who wrote Amy and Isabel, that I think is 3 or 4 years ago. It's very charming, about a mother and a daughter. And this is about a priest, minister, really going through it after the death of his wife. And it is so wonderful. And Madeline and I were saying we didn't understand why everyone hadn't read it. But I saw there's a bunch of them back there, and if you're looking just for a book by an incredibly smart, rich, spiritually and psychologically and lifically rich, that's a wonderful book. And she's coming next week. Oh, she is? Oh, great. She's wonderful. She's a wonderful writer. I loved The World to Come by Dara Horn. Does that sound right? Yeah, and I love The Thin Place by Catherine Davis. And I have just recently discovered Meg Wolitzer, but I think I accidentally read the best book first. So now I'm kind of bummed because the second book I didn't love as much. The one I read that I loved is called The Wife, and it's The Wife, and it's in paper. And those are the books I have loved most recently. Okay, so let's see. And I'm really happy to stay around and sign your books and take questions and just talk about anything you want to ask about. I'm happy to sign. I'm not going to personalize your books, so you can personalize them and I will sign them. But for about 4 different reasons, I'm not going to personalize them. You just have to trust me on this. See if there's any other business to attend to.
What's the name of this book?
The name of the book I'm about to read from? Me. Plan B? That's okay. No, the book back there is, it's called Abide With Me by Elizabeth Strout. It's a follow-up to Amy and Isabel. So people always ask at readings how Sam feels about being written about and how he is in general. And in general, he's fine, although he's 16 and a half. So a lot of people who've only read Operating Instructions saw him in the tiger suit from Mervyn's and think he must be 4 or 5 now. But he's 16 and a half, he's driving, and it's just all a nightmare. So... he's great, and I adore him 80% of the time. There's a piece in Plan B called Sincere Meditations about this wonderful guy named David Roach, who lives down where I live in Marin County in Northern California. And he has severe facial... Oh, in fact, I'll read you a tiny bit from it later. He has severe facial deformities. He's about my... He's mid-50s, I think, 55 or so. And he does a lot of workshops, and he works with adolescents because all of them basically feel sort of facially deformed to begin with. And he really teaches you about the incredible need to find your own beauty, and how he says in this book, in his talks, that his face, which is purple, and the bottom half never grew after he was 2 because he had a tumor radiated, and he's got like not that many teeth and a big tongue, and I said, David, you're all Sam Paku, aren't you? But he really is. But he says, my face is an elaborately disguised gift from God. And it's like the best line in the book. So now you don't even have to buy the book if you don't want to. But he is the pastor of the Church of 80% Sincerity. His premise is that 80% of anything is just a small miracle. 80% sincerity is a lot. But of course, you listen to the culture, and it seems like it's like a B minus. It's like average, almost average. But he said 80% sincerity, 80% of anything. And Sam and I get along beautifully, beautifully, 80% of the time. And the thing about having a 16 and a half year old is that the 20% is so much dicier because they're driving, and they're mouthy, and they're awful, right? So. But he's great, and I think I want to read this piece because I'm missing him tonight. And although I get to go home tomorrow just for a couple of days. And he's very funny. He's completely not like me in very, in most ways he's really his own true self. He's very honest and he's very fair. That's what I would share. I would say those are our best two attributes, is that we're honest and fair. He doesn't like school. He doesn't like to read or write, which I think is kind of an act of aggression against me. And he's very spatial. He's spatially very gifted. He's artistic. He can do graphic animations. He could see the under backside of a pyramid without turning it over, because he can imagine what the bottom on the back would look like, you know. And it's not something he would have to worry about or think about. He can see it the way I could come up with a way to describe something. So he's very tall. He's about 6 feet. He's very lean. He's really on to me. And the other day I was standing around doing something. He said, "Why aren't you doing your cute Annie Lamott slouch?" Isn't that funny? And then I was trying to get all this stuff ready for one morning when we were going to school. And he was going to school, it was right before he got his license. And I was taking our dog for a hike, which I do every morning with some girlfriends and other dog friends. And so I was trying to get all these things together. You know, I had the coffee on top of the car, which I keep swearing I will never do again. Trying to remember the leash, because you get a ticket where I live. And I was trying to remember the dog. I was trying to remember Sam needed some lunch money, and I'd made him some snacks. And Sam looked, and I was just doing everything really badly. And he said, "Mom, I give you maybe 6 good years." So I asked him how he feels about being written about, or actually an interviewer did, and he said, when the hardback came out, and he said, "This has always been what our life is like. She is always either writing or being interviewed or talking at a bookstore." And he said, "I grew up on bookstore floors with bookstore clerks playing with me." And he said, "I grew up with juice boxes and Legos behind her at bookstores." And he said, "I actually don't even think about it, about what it's like for her to write about me." So, but for this book, there's one piece about us being very me being very angry with him. And then there's kind of a longish piece about him at 14. Because I just feel so strongly like I want to be able to remember and look at it again. And the way I take pictures is with words. So this is a piece called Diamond Heart. "If I could only write one more story in my whole life, it would be this. Sam's wrestling practice was canceled one recent afternoon, and he was driving me crazy with his pent-up energy. I was puttering around the house, which is my main spiritual practice, and he kept ambushing me with demands for food or attention and demonstrations of his wrestling menace, grabbing at me as if to put me in a hammer hold, or coming at me as if to pile drive me into the kitchen floor like Hulk Hogan. 'I'm not going to hurt you,' he kept reassuring me, like a serial killer. Flinging his leg around the backs of my knees so that I was afraid they would buckle. I'm 50, but already I'm turning into an old dog with poor vision, dysplasia, achy knees, a weak back, and flatulence. While he is pure, raw, robust animal health, and something in him wants to flip me. He wants to Samoan drop me into the carpet. I put up puny Rose Kennedy Dukes and asked him if he wanted to go for a hike on the mountain. He said yes. He's 4 inches taller than I am. The other day he gave me a goodnight hug and noticed that he was looking down into my eyes. 'Wow,' he said, stepping back. 'When did this happen? You're like a little gnome to me now.' I am shrinking and he is shooting up, but we share that on the inside we both feel no different from children, and we both get a lot of exercise. I am positive of only a few things in life, and one is that if you want to have a decent middle and old age, you have to get exercise almost every day. All the older people who are thriving have stayed physically active. There are exceptions, and everyone knows someone who smoked 2 packs a day and had a few social beers with breakfast every morning who lived to be 85. But you have to assume that this won't be you. You have to assume that without exercise, you'll be the dead one, or if you're lucky, the one in diapers. We headed out to Deer Park, which is the northern face of Mount Tamalpais, about half a mile from our house. I hiked on the southern side of the mountain with my father my whole life until he died. As young children, my brothers and I straggled along behind him, but when I got older, he and I would stride up steep hills together, sometimes in silence, other times talking about books, politics, culture, family. I'd mention books or poems that I knew would please him, Kazantzakis or Proof Rock, and sometimes before a hike, I would read criticism or introductions to works so I could keep up in conversation. I lived for his admiration. I didn't want to instill this need to impress in Sam, and luckily, impress might be a bit strong to describe how Sam acts around me. He loves me most of the time and thinks I'm hilarious, but he doesn't perform the way I did. He doesn't study for our conversations. He doesn't chat up my friends. He doesn't read books so that we can discuss them. In fact, he reads very few books. He reads what he wants, namely magazines in areas I have no opinion or particular interest in, motherboards for his computer, and bike frames. I'd always imagine Sam and me strolling along together, talking like my dad, and I used to talk like my dad and I used to talk about intellectual things. But I get better. I get this. Darling, did you finish Romeo and Juliet? I asked this at the trailhead, hoping to kick off a bookish discussion. And did you like it? Yeah, I loved it. Tell me what you loved, Sam. Great writing, clever story. That was it. We set out on the fire road that leads to a steep trail with Lily racing ahead. Did you ever notice how much Lily looks like Benicio del Toro? Sam asked. It's true. He and Lily dropped behind me, and I walked along, lost in my thoughts in the beauty of the woods. After a while, I reached the high trail that meanders through bay and laurel groves. You get various climates here on the mountain. First, in the English dappled shade, it's cool and it smells like spring and mulch. A few minutes later, you come out from under the trees and you're in Sicily in bright blue heat. Hearing a commotion, I turned to find Sam. He was bashing the ground with a branch, whacking at the low-hanging branches as if they were piñatas. Rather than giving a short talk on honoring the ecosystem that he and his classmates have studied extensively, I continued walking. I rest in silence and music and long strides, while Sam rests in noise and motion. After a moment, he stopped his whacking, and the silence was broken only by birdsong, our footsteps, and invisible animals moving around in the fallen leaves and twigs. Then Sam started whistling. His grandfather taught him to whistle when he was 4, his adopted grandfather, Rex, who was my father's best friend of 30 years. My father died 10 years before Sam was born, and I was still struggling with an achy emptiness, a feeling that my life had been diminished by half at my father's death. How would my books and Sam even matter if my dad wasn't around to be proud? Now he's been dead for as long as I knew him alive, and sometimes when I've done something fabulous, I feel like a gymnast who has performed a flawless routine in an empty auditorium. Sam looks a lot like my father did as a boy. Sam also looks a lot like his own father. The first time Sam and I took a walk with Sam's father, John led the way through the woods behind his own father's house. Sam walked shyly, 10 feet or more behind his dad, and I took up the rear, feeling terror and grief that I was going to have to share my son. But it cheered me to hear him whistling away. It wasn't that he didn't feel shy and nervous. It was just that Rex had taught him how to whistle. Rex was one of the three men who helped raise Sam during his first 5 years, the others being my brother Steve-O, who taught Sam how to wrestle and goof off, and his unofficial big brother Brian, who was bathing and diapering him when he was 2 years old and taking him on adventures ever since. Canoeing, train rides, this part's boring, I'm going to skip ahead. Sam dropped back from me on the trail and then caught up, his edgy psycho scamper. He stabbed the air with his sword, so joyous and masculine. He's always picked up anything that can be used to smash other things, or to make bombs, or to destroy piles of leaves, or sand, or stone. He's a closed current of energy, like those flashlights you squeeze to make the wires connect inside, and then they pour forth their light. He walked with me for a few minutes in silence. He's transparent at these times, like a baby, without any of the barriers or labyrinths people set up later out of fear. Before Sam was born, people told me how utterly transparent with beauty babies could be. I have a photograph on the wall in my study. This part's boring, too. Okay. It's not boring, but it's too thoughtful. Smash. Bash. Whack. Sam swung at the branches above him as if delivering forehand volleys at the net. Sometimes I worry that he takes such joy in wrecking things. When he was two, being just awful and destructive on every level of his pitiful, loathsome, poopy existence, I told my friend Pammy calmly, he's a bad person. He's already ruined. Pammy said something that I have clung to like the last heel of bread. She said, Sam has a deep core of sweetness within him. And she was right. He's deeply compassionate and fair, but he also loves knives and airsoft guns and paintball guns and ninja blades and violence. Maybe it was inconsistent for us to watch Touched by an Angel together right before we watched South Park. Maybe it confused him that we went to church on Sundays and then watched The Sopranos. He's always said the funniest things. Until he was five, he couldn't say L's properly. He pronounced them Y, like Yeef, Yunch, Yov, the Yord, and Sam Yamat. One day he came home from school and said slowly that he had loved his lunch. His teacher had finally taught him L's. He ran next door to show off for the teenagers he adored. It was a bittersweet moment. Your kid can't get a job at CNN if he can't say his L's. But now he's growing up. He'll be dating soon and mouthing off and sneering when he's furious. And that has actually come true already. But now he's the teenager next door that all the other little kids, that all the little kids love. He says things that I scribble down on index cards. Just this morning as I drove him to school, we were talking about politics, and he said, Mom, you know, you have a very rich vocabulary. He can make words all his own. Random is the latest favorite. I'll say something I've been meaning to tell him all day, and he'll look at me askance and say, wow, that was a little random. Driving along with him and his friend Nick the other day, I told Nick, you know, I'll always be one of the adults who is on your side if you ever need me. And he replied, oh, thanks, Annie. And there was silence in the car until Sam said, God, that was random. He can say terrible, mean things to me, and then a few hours later be so kind and contrite that it brings tears to my eyes. He was always this way, accepting and fair, capable of casual meanness and extraordinary empathy. When he was 7 and we started looking for his father, I asked him what he would do if it turned out that his father was strange or standoffish. And Sam said genuinely, oh, I wouldn't care. I wouldn't care if he was a crook. I wouldn't care if he had a gun. I wouldn't care if he cut down trees and didn't replant. Sam began chucking rocks into the creek, and Lily barked at them loyally as if shaking her doggy fist, as if she was saying, "And stay there." I listened to the splashes of the rocks he was pitching, aiming. I'm going to skip ahead. This is such a long, long piece. I'd forgotten. I'll just read the most important parts. I asked a friend of mine who practices a spiritual path called Diamond Heart to explain the name, because I instinctively know that both Sam and I have, or are, diamond hearts. My friend said our hearts are like diamonds because they have the capacity to express divine light, which is love. We not only are portals for this love, but are made of it. She said we are made of light, our hearts faceted and shining, and I believe this to a point. I disagree with her saying we are beings of light wrapped in bodies that merely seem dense and ponderous, yet actually are made of atoms and molecules with infinite space and light between them. It must be easy for her to believe this, as she is quite thin and does not have children. But I can meet her halfway. I think we are diamond hearts wrapped in meatballs. I would call my path diamond meatball. People would comfort and uplift one another by saying, there's a diamond in there somewhere. Still, on better days, I see us as light in containers, like those pierced tin lanterns that always rust, that let the candlelight shine out in beautiful snowflake patterns. Sam raced ahead of me and then slowed down, looking back to gloat at the distance between us. He's very competitive, like me. Then we waved nicely and went on. Oh, Sam, I wonder that I was either too strict or not strict enough. I'm not sure which. I've given him a lot of freedom. He can take public transportation all over the county, but I'm strict about manners and church. You have to contain children or you ruin them, and no one will ever want you to come visit. But children go ballistic when their unfettered spirits feel constricted and picked on by horrible you. They like you less, but if you don't do it, they feel wounded. You shouldn't have even had children, they'll say with contempt. They'll comment on your clothes or your butt in public, or your hair or your grooming. Once when Sam was 12 or so, we were standing in line at the movies, and I found him staring at me judgmentally. What? I asked. When you got your dreadlocks, you made a commitment to keep them groomed, he said. But you've let them get all fuzzy. I'm going to skip ahead. Sam ran ahead, picking up rocks as he went. Lily chased after him. He creates a force field around him that nothing can breach, that comes out of the very center of him. Everything is concentrated on that torque. I watched him go. I've been watching him go since he learned how to crawl. Sometimes I didn't watch closely enough, and he got hurt. He burned his hand badly once, and he split his eyebrow open on a coffee table, and he and his friends got drunk a few times last summer. I'm always afraid he'll end up like I did, drunk and stoned for so many years, and sick in the mornings. Don't worry, Mom, he says, but that's what I used to tell my parents. I tell them what Chef in South Park said. Children, there's a time and place for doing drugs, and it's called college. He smiles, and like a hawk, I watch him go and watch him go and watch him go. Heartbreaking things have befallen some of the children we know, even when their parents keep their eyes open. Cystic fibrosis, truancy, homelessness, alcohol, drugs. Most of them have come through, though, scarred and shaking their heads. Sometimes things were so awful for friends of mine that I thought it was all over. Rocks came tumbling down on them, on their lives. Yet with help, they endured. In some cases, the rocks continue to fall, but even so, when it looks to the outside world as if they are doomed, it turns out that something inside is slowly being fused back together. They find an underground, wiggly strength. Sam stomped ahead of me like a mountain goat to the top of the hill and waited. When I caught up with him, he stuck his branch out to pull me up, I thought, but he pantomimed a sword fight and poked me. God, I said involuntarily, knowing it was an accident. Can you cut me a little slack? I'm sorry. My bad. He reached out and pulled me the last few steps to the top. I walked until I came upon the view of a million fleecy trees, the foothills of Mount Tam. I sat down. What if there's another 9/11, he said. What made you think of that? I asked. He shrugged. Is there any situation where you would kill Lily? Of course not. That's our dog, I think I mentioned. Of course not, unless she was very ill. What if there was another 9/11, though, he said, and we didn't have any food? You wouldn't kill Lily to feed me? You just can't win. Sam, I laughed, but he was serious. Okay, honey, I said, I'll kill Lily. If there was nothing left, would you let me kill you and eat you? Sure, honey. I wouldn't want you to die necessarily, Mom. I might just cut off your arm to survive. Well, help yourself. What if there is another attack here this time? Then we'll all band together and share what we have. Will we have to share with Uncle and Jamie? He gave me his trademark look, a long, slow, sideways glance. He was suppressing a smile. Of course we will. He's my brother, Sam. Yeah, but he and Jamie eat so much. And now with the baby, too many mouths to feed. Sam can always make me laugh. I know where he got his gallows humor. I can see myself so clearly in him, many of my worst traits and some of my goodness. I also can still see many of Sam's ages in him. New parents grieve as their babies get bigger because they cannot imagine the child will ever be so heartbreakingly cute and needy again. Sam is a swirl of every age he's ever been, and all the new ones, like cotton candy, like the Milky Way. I can see the stoned wonder of the toddler, the watchfulness of the young child sopping stuff up, the busy purpose and workmanship of the 9-year-old. I see him and his oldest friend Jack outside working on an electric fence, taping 6-volt batteries to our fence, using endless amounts of duct tape and wires and switches. I see him fashioning robots at the kitchen table with bits of junk, a glue gun, and a 9-volt battery. I see him at my desk making a small electric fan that works. He can get most of his inventions to light up or walk. He invents the same way I write. As Virginia Woolf said, arrange whatever pieces come your way. Sam creates things out of whatever grabs his attention. Bits of plastic, toys, cloth, balloons, fool's gold, mirrors, batteries. He came and stood beside me, silent. What do you think about when you come here? This is where I most feel the presence of God, I said, except for at church. He looked out at the mountainside, at a hawk, at turkey vultures circling, at birds singing in the brush. Can I sit in your yap? He asked. I was sitting cross-legged in the dirt, and he plopped down into my lap. He weighed a ton. I couldn't have gotten up if I'd wanted to. I held him loosely and smelled his neck. Sometimes when I dream about him, he's in danger. He's doing things that are too risky. But most of the time, he's stomping around or we're just hanging out together. Sometimes I dream about him when he was younger, and I remember it with such sweetness that it wakes me. So, anybody have any questions about anything? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, how Pammy's daughter is just magnificent. She's 14 now. She'll be 15 soon. She's much taller than I am, and everyone, all these kids are so lean and lanky, or the ones I know. And she's just incredible human, and I adore her. She's still like a filly. I described her in Traveling Mercies as being like a filly when she was 2 or something, and she's just artistic. She's a sewer. She's had a lot of, you know, the world gives you other mothers. I had a mother who needed me to mother her. But the world really provided me with a lot of mothers, and I sort of made a quilt of mothers out of them, like the mothers of best friends and stuff. And Rebecca, she used to be, she's Becky now, but Rebecca has just had incredible mothers around her. Okay, you can ask a second question. What do I think about the Million Little Pieces controversy? I couldn't put the book down when I read it. But I didn't know, I actually thought a lot of it was really suspicious, because I knew it was at Hazelden, and it didn't sound remotely like a real rehab facility, because it was just so unstructured, and there were just so many ways to escape, and so many beatings going on in the bathroom, and really just like extreme abuse, I would characterize it. But it was like getting on a train, you know, and just rolling along. And then I have to say, I found it so bizarre when word came out, I guess through Smoking Gun first, that a lot of it was made up, really most of it, except that he had been an alcoholic and drug addict. And for about 3 days, I just felt schadenfreude, you know. I just felt so happy because he sold hundreds, millions and millions of books, and he's so rich. And so I just felt this kind of glee for about 3 days, because I'm basically not a good Christian at all. I'm really not. I'm really seriously not. And then by about the third day, it was so awful what they were doing to him. It was like, you know, in the Jamestown colony, you know, it was like, and then when Oprah had him and Nantelise, who was like the sweetest, most brilliant editor, she's married to Gay Talese, and she's this very elegant New York City editor, and she was asked on the show, but she wasn't told that they were going to just like flay Jim Fry. And then all these other people showed up to get in on it, you know, like Maureen Dowd, whose work I'm crazy about, and Frank Rich, who I love his column, somebody else from the Washington Post, and I just found it unbearable. I mean, I felt like my entire childhood was flashing before my eyes, and I felt like Oprah was just must have been in so much grief and confusion, because she was, it felt sadistic to me. My stomach got really clenched up, and I felt mortified for him. Of course, I kept it on. I mean, it was mesmerizing, you know. It was like Cobra hypnosis. Going, whoa, whoa, whoa. I was so glad it wasn't me. Oh, my God. And what I felt was like I could never be accused of plagiarism, because basically not all that much ever happens in any of my stories. Like, I wake up, and all my mental illnesses I've gotten up before me, and they're sitting on the bed, and they've had coffee, and they're bored, and they want to talk, and Bush is still president, and then I go and I make coffee, and I let my dog out, I take care of the animals, and then I try to get Sam some snacks for school, and then he has to get himself up now and make his bed, and do all this stuff, and then at some point either he's mean to me or something goes really wrong, and then I think it's all hopeless, and that if I were God, I would have a completely different system, which I would, by the way. I would so have a different system. There's a piece in here, I forgot where it is, but I just said, if I were God, I would have all the answers at the back of the workbook so that you could just keep checking as you went along and see if you were even on the right track, you know? And so then I'm really, and then there's some tiny shift. They're like the plates of the earth shift. There's never like white light filling the room, or, you know, almost nothing happens. I'll remember something. My pastor will say something. I'll see something totally incongruous, and the plates will shift, and I'll get my sense of humor back. And then once you get your sense of humor back, you're fine. There's a line in here I like a lot that says, laughter is carbonated holiness. And I really believe that that is true. I believe laughter is one of the forms of God's love. So that's what I thought. I mean, everything you probably thought. And then he's still selling. He's selling more books than God has, you know? And I saw somebody reading A Million Little Pieces at the airport on Monday morning. And it was a young woman, and I wanted to go up to her and say, why are you reading that in the aftermath? And the reason is that it's just mesmerizing. It's so raw. It's so stripped down to the kind of a howl. And you know that is in you. And I think a lot of us, especially those of us that were raised to be perfectionists, were scared to death of getting busted at a big level. I mean, Oprah show's pretty big. But that was a huge fear of mine, always, because I was raised by perfectionists to be a perfectionist, so I was always afraid I'd get busted. And I just danced as fast as I could, and And when I saw it, I mean, I was kind of terrorized by that, the Oprah show, the day that that happened. I was really blown away. Yeah. The protest, the revolution I'm planning? Oh, yeah. So I'm planning a revolution for July 14th. I hope that works for everyone. That's Bastille Day, and it's also my boyfriend's birthday, and I thought I could, like, make him think it was, like, a big surprise party. Because I was in Washington, D.C. on the 10th, which was my birthday, and I was so exhausted because I'd been in New York before that and all over the place. And I was kind of bitter, you know, it was my birthday, no one knew it. And I went out, I just started to head towards the mall just because I always love to be there, and there were 200,000 people, mostly Spanish and Latino, at an immigrant rights rally. And so I pretended it was a surprise party for me for a while. Oh, you shouldn't have, but there's really no place on earth I'd rather be than a rally, for a peace march or a protest rally. So anyway, I was thinking, the thing that goes wrong with rallies is that they're usually sponsored by people with really feverish positions on things like Israel and Palestine and labor and free trade and fair trade. And so they always just get so, like in the San Francisco peace marches, the punks for peace always show up eventually. And they're always okay in the beginning, but they bring backpacks full of rocks. And then at the end, they've been drinking, and then they smash the newspaper things, containers. And so I thought it would be so great just not to have a single issue, except for libraries. There'd be two issues, libraries and kindness. And you know, the Dalai Lama said, my only true religion is kindness. And I think it's all anyone has to remember. That's all I have to remember on any given day. And my father wrote a book called The Bastille Day Parade when I was 14 or something, like in the late 60s. I don't even remember when I was 14, 68 or 69. Yeah, I was 68. In 68, I was 14, but I think it was 69. And it was about a protest march. It begins in a protest march on the Golden Gate Bridge where people are crossing holding placards that say, turn off the lie machine. And so I thought, just for my father and all those, my dad would have been he'd be like 83 now, I think. And he was just such a good old, you know, union guy and lefty and just such a peacenik, and you know, and he and his friend Rex were actually read about. They were like on the vanguard of the Sierra Club consciousness, you know, and just really getting like the first thing was the littering campaigns that just in the 50s they were little by. I mean, the first thing was probably Smokey the Bear, and then littering. And these guys and my mom's best friends. This is what they did. This was their religion. They were not religious people, and this was their religion: was that you fought for the poor, you fought for working class people, you fought for the Redwood Forest. And so I thought that's why it would be on July 14th. There'd be no issues. And let's see, there are a couple other things, though. You're supposed to bring a piece of fruit. Because I heard Mother Teresa once say that in India, people will be in the gutters dying, and they'll have a bit of fruit, and they'll be sharing it. Because that's their consciousness. They'll be breaking a banana off in half, you know. And here, it's like you can't amass enough bananas. And you try to, the corporate world is about amassing as many bananas as you can and then selling them at as great a profit as you can. And so they mostly go bad. And the world is starving to death and going crazy. And so I thought we'd bring a bit of fruit and bring like $2 or $3 to share in case you see somebody who's just desperately poor. But there'd be no screeds and there'd be no chanting. It would be great if everyone could remember to turn off their cell phones. And I was thinking noonish. But my revolution has stalled since my book tour began. So I have to get back on it. There's still obviously some details to figure out.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for William Haywood Henderson, John Perkins, Rick Riley, Nando Parado, Augustine Burroughs, Madeline Albright, Elizabeth Strout, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on April 19th, 2006.